Tom Neary tape 2.
Tom, we were
talking when that stopped on the tape there about, you got as far as Gateshead after Dunkirk. But your service number, by the way, what was your service number, Tom?
338-8401.
Thank you.
And what happened when you got back to Southampton? What was the reaction at Southampton?
Oh, there were plenty of people about. The ladies were out, the canteen, made it a great welcome, drinks of tea, sandwiches, you know. They couldn't have been nicer. So we wasn't hungry overnight travel. They gave us enough to sustain us till we got to Durham. Of course, I said we went from there to Gateshead, and the Oakwell Gates was right on the banks of the Tyne. And while we was there, of course, we got a little bit of spending money. We went in the big pub that was on the Tyne Bridge and the Gateshead side, called the Half Moon Hotel. Of course, when we went in there, they knew what we were and that. They couldn't give us enough. Generosity was marvellous. Fine people.
But your whole reaction to that traumatic time in Dunkirk, the fighting and so on, getting your way back to St Malo, and the rest of the battalion at Dunkirk and so on, I mean, it must have been very traumatic. And
it was a shambles. We went out there. We wasn't prepared for what we were going to see or what we were going into. We were trying to fight as a 1914 war. All that we had with us was, for myself, I had a Lee Enfield rifle, a bandolier of extra 50 rounds of ammunition in a cloth around the shoulders, and a few extra in my pouches. We consisted of one brain gun to a platoon. We had what they called the boys' anti-tank rifle, 48 pound, I think it was, about 3'6" long, comparatively light and mobile, fired a bullet 0.55, big flash, big kick, and it bounced off.
Yeah.
It was useless. And that is what we had to meet the modern German army with. And that goes for all battalions.
Because the German army at that stage was beating everything in sight, presumably, wasn't it?
Yeah, did nothing to stop them.
Yeah.
The morning with the fast approach with their armoured cars and tanks coming through, then there was nothing needed. And of course, preceded by the Luftwaffe with the Stuka dive bombers, coming ahead, screaming ahead, demoralising. Then they come through, plus the fifth colonists we had to put up with, were dressed as always, and you didn't know who and what was what. Everything was one big shambles. France was corrupt, and England was into it, and we wasn't prepared for it.
Yeah.
I honestly think that they called Chamberlain, but what Chamberlain actually did gave us a year to help. It did help a little.
Yeah.
You know.
So we would never have survived over there.
Oh, no way. No way. No.
Because of the difference in the way we were trying to fight the war and the reality of the way the Germans were fighting.
That's right.
The equipment they had and so on.
It was great, yeah. It was disgrace. It wasn't the British soldier. It was what he was given. You know.
Did you see any armour over there, German armour at that stage?
Oh, yeah. I've seen a bit of French armour too. It was a little. And very little of our planes either, but of course we're fighting elsewhere. Mm. Yeah, mostly what I see were armoured cars. The tanks, I understand, of course, were advanced for the time, but all we had in a battalion then, and I never seen them, if they had attached to the brigade, was 2-pounder anti-tank guns. Mm. I'd never see them in action anyhow. So all that it really amounted to was, with the battalions also, was the boys' anti-tank rifle, the Bren guns, rifles, and that was it.
You had no armour support or
no.
Heavy guns or
no.
Anything like that?
No. No.
Yeah, so it's not surprising that you didn't really stand much of a chance against what you were faced with.
No, with no chance, really. No, if you really be honest about it, without manoeuvring and outgunned, we hadn't been. Was fighting, like I say. It wasn't only 1914, really. We're fighting, which was a good rifle, the Enfield rifle.
That was a 303 tank.
Yeah, the RC, First World War. Good rifle, like I say. With the Bren gun, which fired from a magazine. Excellent gun, machine gun, but when it was fighting against the Germans, even in those days, they had machine guns that were firing to roughly 1,000 rounds a minute, and we were chugging away with the Bren gun. You know, but it was good, and it's light and it's mobile to run with. And that was it.
What about the leadership, though, some of that stage? Because after the First World War, the thinking of the First World War of the leadership was, well, people didn't rate the leadership very highly, did they?
No.
And I wonder how that, whether that sort of mentality went forward to this period.
Well, all I can say, from what my view was, an infantry private, of course, I never see any brass arts, as a term, and the generals. I've seen a brigadier, but, you know, but that was only really. So the highest we really see was a battalion commander, you know, the colonel, lieutenant colonel, major and captains, and it was more or less, even with Dunkirk, it was more or less company, you know, where I would, company, because it's coming through that fast and around the side, the individual actions, you know. That's how it consisted of. And then again, as you said, you know, every man for himself. I mean,
but leadership at that level, it's a company level, major and below, I
suppose. Yeah, they're mostly captain in 1940 for company commander. Yeah.
But at that level, they were okay, were they? Or
oh, the men, man. They're fine men, yeah. Fine men. I couldn't. Yeah. Like Captain Hawes, who I told you about, you know. Yeah, fine, Mr. Man. Efficient. But he could only do as efficient he could what he got.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I have none whatsoever. The officers, of course, it changes when you're in the field of action. Things change rapidly. Between from that date, and it's known, between the men who's been into action and those who haven't, I mean, even between the officers and the men, there's a slight difference, you know.
Yeah. Because going on from what we're talking about, which is the quality of the men in your regiment in the East Lancashire.
Grandfellas.
Because there is a story, isn't there, which you can tell us and tell us more about, with something that was happening at Dunkirk, which is where the 1st Battalion were fighting at Dunkirk. And there was a medal one there, wasn't there?
Oh, yes.
These were the people you were trying to get through to.
That's right. Captain Irving Andrews, VC. First time VC of the war. An Irishman. The county Louth he came from. So eventually I joined his company, B Company. He was a fine officer. A real gentleman. Good with his men. Well liked. And of course he admitted himself, he was so humble that he said, if I got it, it's the men earned it, because he backed him up. Oh, he was a real outstanding officer, and of course the colonel of the both battalions, both the 1st and the 4th were grandfellas. The 1st battalion commander at that time, he was Lieutenant Colonel Pendlebury, DSO, he became Brigadier Pendlebury afterwards, after Dunkirk. The 4th Battalion Commander, who I never called Robinson, came from Blackburn, a solicitor, Territorial Army. So when I came back and we left Newcastle Station on Saturday afternoon, around lunchtime, and eventually it chugged along and along and stopped at Saturday about tea time, and there we were at Blackburn Station.
Who were there, sir?
The oldest party of 50 men or so.
Right.
All 4th Battalion men. What are we doing here? So, off it goes again, and it stops at Worley, and we got off at Worley, which is about 4 miles out of Blackburn. Saturday night, that's off Worley Station on Mitten Road, on up the Brew, Worley Brew, till we came to Portfield Bar, they call it, to the right road, going in towards Accrington, Clayton, the left one goes to Paddington and Burnley. So we marched up the road on this road, stopped up this long track, about half a mile, to a place called Morton Hall. and there we were stationed. So while I was there, said to me, right, are you in charge of the canteen? Which was a good show. So, I did this canteen, but this was on a Saturday night. So Sunday came, of course. There was nothing much to do. The captain didn't bother. He said, okay. So, of course, biggest part was from over the area. Some went to Darwin, some went to Blackburn, and I went to Clapton outside of Burnley. And Bunch went to Burnley. So we came back at night. This carried on to about Tuesday or Wednesday. And then they said, well, you've got 48 hours leave, and for those that live down the south, there's 48 hours for travelling, so we've got 4 days leave. They report back to St. Mary's Hall, Stonyhurst College. So I was there for 4 days, came Sunday after night, set off back, landed Stonyhurst, which is miles out in the country.
Did you, at that stage, when you had 4 days leave at home, and that's the first time you've been home after going overseas?
That's right.
So your mum and dad were there?
Yeah.
You must have had some chats and conversations with your mum and dad at that stage, and they were, must have been very happy to see you alive and well and happy and so on and so forth.
Yeah, I never told them anything. I didn't ever mention it. I never mentioned the war to my parents, or even after to my wife for 40 years it would be. I didn't say anything to anyone about it.
But did your dad, because your dad being an
oh,
army
person, yeah,
he must have asked you my uncle's
and all, mother's brothers, yeah.
But your reaction was, I don't want to talk about it.
Then they didn't pester me, they just left it, no. Yeah. No, they never even asked me anything. I might, in a little bit of, like we did French, we say bon santé, you know, and then we spoke a bit of French or something like that, but as regards they just left it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All they said, I think if I remember right, well, it'll come round cycle, they'll get it back, and that was it. Which they did get it back.
Because I suppose the papers at that stage were full of the publicity of what happened on Dunkirk.
That's right. A lot of it, of course, like the old in old paper, a lot of it was bull. You know, they say so much, but of course, we know it's censored, so they only put in what. So we lost quite a few East Lancashire men there from 1st Battalion and 4th Battalion. Anyhow, I was only there skimming it over at St. Mary's Hall. So when we finished there this night, we said, oh, well, it's too late to go home to Blackburn and Burnley, and that would just go down into Whalley. So we're down into Whalley. By that time, of course, Gibbons hadn't got shut of his pants either. So
from the
early
on.
That's right. So we went down and we just went and had a pint or two and playing dominoes in the dog in Whalley. Nice night, just lads together. Came out, the bus had gone, so we had to walk it back to Stonyhurst College, which is a long way. Few miles, anyhow. So we're setting off in twos, and of course Gibbons and me is at the back. So when we get to St. Mary's Hall at Stonyhurst, it was midnight. Of course, being a training holding camp, whatever it was, the regimental police were on the gate, being officious, they booked us. So they all go in, and we all got booked. Morning. In the hall, which is a typical college with a long corridor with all the doors opening off, company office. So we lined up in the corridor, in, out, admonished, but they all got away with it. So last in, of course, is Gibbons and me. Get in. Right. Gibbons had been a sergeant who'd been demoted for one thing or another, and there's me. And he was a territorial, I thought he'd been in a few years, 5 or 6 years, I think. Right, you are a bad example to the recruits. This was Major Barnes, he was called. No way will it do. Right, 5 days CB and 5 days Royal Warrant. Thanks very much. Yeah. So, that meant 10 days pay and five. So, of course, we was on jankers or defaulters, want to be polite, at night. And then all the rest of the lads went to Blackburn. There we were stuck there in the officer's mess. But, of course, we had bench, we got extra scoff light. So, and it poured down. So we had to say, screw job, we wouldn't go, you know. So, they come back, they were drenched. Morning came, this list went up on the wall. Transfer, put, drafted, posted to 1st Battalion Lancaster Regiment. So, there we were on this draft. So, the day following, Wallace Station, on the train, and we finished up in North Hallerton, yeah. North Riding, Yorkshire. They're waiting for us there. They split it up according to it was alphabetical order, whatever it may be, and I joined B Company, and some of the other mates were sent to other companies, so it split us up. I went to B Company at Kipling Hall, at, outside a village called Scorton, about 5 miles out in North Hallerton. So I joined B Company there, where the company commander then was Captain Irving Andrews, VC.
This was
this
B,
was
B Company, 1st Battalion, East Lancashire.
Yeah. So that would be...
when was that?
In July
of
1940. And of course, they're all mixed up. There was, they had reinforcements from the King's Liverpools and all sorts there. So Kipling Hall, I understood, was associated, so I was told, with Queen Elizabeth I, so somebody, I don't know if it's true or not. But anyhow, as you went down into Scorton Village itself, there's a hospital there for the incurables that run by the Order of St. John of God. I remember it quite plain. So I was there. Oh... We shoved it, well, first of all, they shoved it in, into a stable. Because recruits, and we just arrived, not recruits, but reinforcements.
Yeah.
So we were in this year, you crack up a door. So we come to the office, so we went, lined up outside, the sergeant major came up. Corporal Ingham said to me, "What's this bugger? It's Spit Fleming." "Who the hell's Spit Fleming?"
His name was Spit Fleming.
He was called Fleming, so they called him Spit.
Yeah.
See. He was CSM.
Yeah.
I got to go in a smashing colour. Anyhow, march in to see the company commander. So, Lord Crawley went in first, Corporal Ingham. Remember the name. Comes out, he said, "Whatever you do, don't laugh." I said, "Don't laugh? Why don't laugh?" He said, "Because if you laugh, you're in a bloody gate. Because he looks like he's smiling, but he's actually not smiling." So, we didn't bloody smile.
This was Fleming.
No, this was the company commander.
Right.
Fleming marched us in,
yeah,
to the company commander, you see, you know, quick march, you know.
Yeah.
So he'd been in, he knew, he's an old soldier, you see, and he knew them. And this man, I think after, he's very high up in the legal profession. And he was called Drury. So, actually, I was wrong there. Irving Andrews wasn't there at that time. He was away and he came back. Now, I never seen this chap after. Anyhow, don't worry, you don't smile. So he come out, and he did. He smiled. You think he smiled, like he actually wasn't, you see. So we came out, no trouble, back into this here. Went for meals, and we're there 4 days, and nobody bothered us.
Yeah.
Just so eventually, oh, they realised he was there. So they we integrated with the company. This day, in this room, it had the big windows, you know, the opened out French windows.
Yeah.
And it's sergeant showing us how you do with a grenade, you know,
yes,
where you don't, if you don't pull the fulcrum lever, don't pull the pin out and let the fulcrum lever, you can put the pin back, you know. But when they looked at it.
So, what does that mean? It means that you can hold this.
You can hold the grenade,
yeah,
in your hand, and it's like two lugs on it. Comes round, it has a lever goes down the side like that, but there's a pin goes through the top, a split pin. You put it through and it splits. So that holds the lever down, it can't move.
Right.
So when you're going to open, you're going to throw the grenade, you pull the ring, and of course the pin comes out, and you still have hold it like that with the lever down.
Yeah.
Now, if it's in active service, it's a 4 second fuse. But if it's a train, it's 7 seconds. It should be. But if you don't hold it enough, the lever will click, and if you let it, it's a fuse, and it's 4 seconds, and then it goes up, you know.
You've got to hold it firmly.
Or you have to keep it closed, yeah,
the
keep the lever in, yeah,
yeah.
And then you can shove the pin back.
Yeah, okay.
But he's doing this, trying to do this, and they said, look. And it was, but he was smoking this one.
Yeah.
And he threw it through the window, of course it went up.
Right.
This would be...
It was alive for night.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
So then we eventually moved from there. Doing guard down to RHQ was at Enderby Steeple. But we moved from there at the beginning of September, and we moved down by wagon, lorries. We moved down and we finished at Broadway outside of Cheltenham.
Yeah, that's in Cotswolds.
That's right. But
before you go to Broadway, because there's an important period there, isn't there? This is July to September 1940.
That's right.
Battle of Britain is going on.
That's right.
And the country really is expecting invasion.
Of course.
Yeah.
But there was what they were doing, I came back with my rifle and all my kit. I had nothing lost. I'd come back in a proper manner. I didn't, They assumed swimming out not having a rifle. These Lancashires were told, in any case, anyone who hadn't his come back with his kit, that was his lot. So we came back with what we went with. We wouldn't very much. Anyhow, we moved down to Broadway on the canvas. And I think the second night we was there, we were eight of us in a bell tent. And about 2 a.m, the alarm went off. Invasion scare. So in the dark, no lights, it's going on, and what a shambles in it were in the tent. Jack Hurst and this other fellow, I can't remember who Roberts or not, one who got his leg in one pant, and he got his leg in. But anyhow, he sorted himself out. We stood through all night, stood down, and the invasion never occurred. 2 days after that, off we moved again, and we finished up at Bisham Abbey, outside of Marlow in Buckinghamshire.
Yeah, now that's where Bisham Abbey is, where the England football team, I think, train or something.
That's right.
Yeah.
So when we got there, and it was evening, he said, 10 men to a tree. So we ran the tree, we slept. So the day after, they came with the marquees and put the marquees up. Pretty hard, rough life. Marquees up, and we worked them together, got them up, and in the big park of Bisham Abbey. Now, the Abbey itself, I understand many years later, belonged to Lord Vansittart. And when you went, I'd only been in it downstairs, when you went in through the main door, the archway, it had all the Latin inscriptions around it, which of course it must have been Abbey at some stage.
And you could translate those, Tom, could you?
Yeah, if I could, yeah, if it's not too elaborate in the doing, I could,
because
yeah.
Earlier that
that's right, yeah. So, what they did while they was there, they had a tower at part of the Abbey, and on the tower, they had a watch post where they had this gadget that it could go around degrees, and as it came over and bombed, and as any fire started, they could point in the direction that it was, and they knew the area. They were phoned through by telephone to get them out there to put the fires out. Now, in the turn, the companies had to so many men to go and do this, and then they did 2 hours on and off, so they slept in this long gallery. And we had in our company two Scousers, Liverpoolers, Ashcroft and Kane, they were called, mad chaps, like the booze, good soldiers, smart soldiers. So they were on with this eight that was on, they would be in their turn. So when they came off, they slept in this long gallery. Anyhow, morning came, and have you heard about Ashcroft and Kane? Said, what about Ashcroft and Kane? They're not bloody going back in that Mr. Mabby again. What for? It's haunted. They said, don't talk so much. I'm telling you, you mind what you say to me, because they thump you one. So I said to them, hey, what are you on about this here? Don't you come it, they said. We were we got down on the floor in this long gallery. And this woman's coming along in grey. They said, they said, yeah, bloody drunk. How could we be drunk when we've been on duty? We're not going back in that bloody place, they said.
Yeah.
So a few days after, we was allowed down into Marlow. Yeah, from Bissam Abbey, you went over the River Thames, over this bridge, and you're into Marlow, lovely town. In the pubs there. Where are you lads be from? Oh, Lancashire. Oh, where is St. Bissam Abbey? Hey, that place be haunted. You know?
Yeah. Confirmation of what these chaps said they saw.
That's right. Yeah. So I was there, and while I was there, of course, they were bombing London. They came over in the mist one morning. This bloody Dornier plane came over, it was only 50 feet up. It must have been badly damaged, and it zoomed over us and it crashed. Then they came over and bombed us and blew all the fish out of the river, and there were fish all over the Bissam Abbey Park.
So you've had loads falling from the sky earlier, and then you've got fish.
Yeah, northern fishes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's true. Yeah, I mean, you can check in the, you know. Yeah. Oh, yeah, the fish all over the place there were at Bissam Abbey. So we was there, and then the movie company, we went to a place called Burnham Beaches. I don't know much about it. I know it was in this big house. And it was late on then into October. But we moved from Burnham Beaches. The Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Pendlebury, DSO, he got to move upstairs and became Brigadier. And the Colonel that took place was called Will, Lieutenant Colonel Will. So we moved from there, from this one and Burnham Beaches, on the trucks, through the night, and drowned and going right, we kept looking at the same name place, we've gone to this village three times. Eventually we finished up at Lowestoft. So we're on the defences at Lowestoft, which we stayed through November into December, and then while we were there, they came over and bombed it. Not much, but they did. So we're on coastal defence there. It was a miserable place in that time of the year and wartime. So we moved from there and we finished in Watford in December 1940.
Because by then, I suppose, the fear of invasion had gone.
The main scare had gone.
December of 14.
Just bombing London, yeah.
Yeah, because they wouldn't have come, presumably, in winter time, if they were across the channel.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, for our battalion then, we moved into Watford, and the people of Watford were smashing. Made us very welcome. We were with them then till the end of February. Oh, we didn't want to leave, but it was a fine station, fine people. So we moved from there and we went down to Leon Sea, and we were there getting on towards a week roughly, I think. Well, at that time, of course, Leon Sea was dead like anything else. There weren't much to go, you know, after being in Watford. And we moved from there and we went to a place called Gosfield Park, which was 3 miles from Alstead in Essex and about 5 or 6 miles from Braintree. So we was in on the canvas there with 3 bell tents inside a marquee to try and keep you warm and oil lamps going. But there were that many with the cold, it was really cold weather, that decided it wasn't fit to be there. So they sent a gang of us up to a place called Mushroom Farm, about 5 miles away, where it was big enough to hold a brigade, and they broke these huts with all no windows in them and all these mushroom beds. So we had to break them up with the sledgehammers, we brought them up, emptied them out, the electric lights on all the time, so we was in Mushroom Farm then for about 5 or 6 weeks.
I mean, that doesn't sound too comfortable, because I always imagine mushroom farms as being then dark.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, there's no windows, so you were dark, you had to have light on all the time.
Yeah.
But it was also a brigade headquarters, so that is where we were doing the punched up guard. The regimental had two on guard at once, and the guard drilled the day before you went on. So we were there for 6 days, and then we moved back to Gosfield Park. So we were there in Gosfield Park in May and June, but in between we had a fortnight where we went to watch camp at Colchester on a firing range at live ammunition, firing and throwing grenades. What was there? There was trenches that had been dug, and you're lobbing these grenades with the 7 second fuses, and it was a zigzag trench. We had a fellow with us called Ducky, Duckworth, and he called him Ducky. So he's throwing this grenade, and he's throwing it, you know. His hand caught the back of the slit trench. Bloody bomb rolled into the trench. Look at
that.
That
he was in.
Huh?
Yeah.
So, as I said, it was zigzag. So we dived round the corner. It went up, you know. But of course, nobody. It's how it happens. So off we did training there. Came back to Gosfield Park, big park, regimental guards, all that. Across the road, down the road was a pub at 3 miles into Alstead. Then we used to do route marches, of course, right through into Alstead, right through from Alstead into Sudbury.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sudbury into Bury St Edmunds, yeah, which were into Suffolk, of course. And then we did these manoeuvres, what was going on the rest, and we marched back again.
Was there much in around the area? Because I know a bit later on in the war, around the area, Suffolk and Norfolk, there are lots of RAF stations and American Air Force stations.
Yeah.
Was there much sign of that around there?
No, not particularly. We knew the Yanks were there, but we actually didn't see them. I didn't see them till we got into Ipswich, and then there was that Martlesholme aerodrome.
Yeah.
I've got the right name.
Martlesholme, I think.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. Martlesholme, yeah.